When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Section 30 of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace. This is a LibriVox recording and is in the public domain. The Duke Remains, Part 3. Alicia Terrell did not view the broccoli aristocrat with unmixed joy. Even the lines 2AT with the homage of RN did little to reconstruct her sentiments in the matter. They ran, "Thou peerless daughter of the age, so beautiful and fearless, there soon shall come another stage when thou wilt not be peerless." She thought them rather impertinent, and it may be said that she did not like Mr. Nape over much. Her objection to the aristocrat was its irritating appearance of permanency. She was a girl with decided views. What elusive quality is it that makes for success in a newspaper? Is it purely a literary one or a typographical one? Is it the choice of matter or the arrangement of type? Perhaps a little of each. What it was that made the broccoli aristocrat successful from its very commencement may have been the individuality that lived in its pages, the deft touch of genius, the gloss and the brilliance of the superlative merit. In its first number, it claimed, modestly enough, to be of its kind unique. "The broccoli aristocrat," said the restrained notice, "will contain all the news worth reading and all the views worth writing. It will be a newspaper devoted to the best interests of the best people." Mr. Nape, its nominal editor, rose nobly to his responsibilities. Most assiduously did he apply himself to the study of all that was most noteworthy in current journalism. He studied the back files of the Saturday Review, and acquired the style caustic. He diligently acquainted himself with the imperialism of the Spectator and the National Review, and instantly secured the soundest of views on the Navy. He read from cover to cover the words of Miss Corelli and learnt all about editors, how bad editors are grossly fat and have pronounced Hebraic features, and how good editors are pretty scarce. He took lessons in journalism from a gentleman who guaranteed to turn a dustman into a reviewer in 12 lessons, and he read the life of Delane. Little wonder that the aristocrat came to fame in a short space of time with such determined strivings after perfection behind it. Little wonder that the people began to read it and to look forward to Friday when it was published, and to take sides in the controversy that raged between its proprietor and the owner of the Lewisham and Lee Mail. "It isn't that I want them to take sides," said the Duke, "but I want to get them interested in me. It was the only method I could think of. You see, I'm naturally of a shy and shrinking disposition, and I find it difficult to convey to comparative strangers a sense of my all-around excellences." He was paying one of his rare visits to Alicia in her own home. The outward and visible result of his hurricane courtship glittered on the third finger of her left hand. "But surely," she urged a little impatiently, she was a real girl, and this is a true story, "you have some plans for the future. You do not intend to end your days in broccoli." He nodded his head. "I can imagine nothing more satisfying," he said, "than to pass to the dark beyond, to the bourne from which, in the midst of mine own people." "The calm way in which you have appropriated us all," she said with a smile which was half amusement and half vexation, "is too appalling. But, dear, there is me." "There is you," he repeated with a twinkle in his eye. "I've thought of that. You shall stay and share my glories." In the suburbs? She lifted her eyebrows. In the suburbs, said the Duke. We will take some nice house and call it Chateau de Montbillet, with a nice garden and a nice coach house and a hot and cold shower, she went on icily, with a month in Margate every summer and a round of local pantomimes every winter. Thank you. As for myself, said the Duke dreamily, I shall stand for the Board of Guardians. What? Board of Guardians, said the Duke firmly. It has been one of my life's dreams in faraway San Pio in my cow-punching days, when I used to lie out on the prairie all alone with the great stars glittering in the unbroken solitude of the wilderness about me. That was the thought that comforted me, the whispered hope that buoyed me up to be a guardian. The trees in their rustling murmured the word. The far-off howl of the prairie dog was to my fevered imagination the voice of the chairman calling the board to order. Oh, but seriously, she pleaded, please, please be serious. I am serious, said the indignant Duke. Broccoli is nature, and all that pertains to broccoli is nature. Why, even Tuppy sees that. When I told him that the mayor didn't wear robes and didn't have a mace bearer, the poor chap nearly wept for joy. I am not interested in what Tuppy thinks, she said coldly, or what Tuppy has planned. What interests me is the fact that I have no intention whatsoever of spending my life in the suburbs. So, there. I wonder if so there, an expression that a lady who had at one time lived in Portland Place would use. I wonder. Alicia Terrell was angry, and not without cause. Women have no sense of men's humor, and I do not think the Duke was tactful. He was a young man who took things for granted. Had Alicia been an heiress, she might have entered into the spirit of the Duke's humor. She could have afforded the whim, but she was not rich. Money is a horrid thing, and especially horrid to the poor girl who marries the rich man, however sincere and wholehearted her love is for him and his for her. For there comes, and there must come, an unpleasant feeling of dependence, a sensation such as must have been experienced by the unfortunate Negroes who lived in Uncle Tom's cabin and nowhere else, when the whip of the overseer cracked, that is particularly irksome to a girl of independent character. The Duke, as I say, took much for granted. Money was as nothing to him. He did not count it as a serious factor in life. People with money seldom do. You may say, having in mind the incidents of the Duke's tempestuous wooing, that there was little solid foundation for a true and abiding companionship, such as marriage implies, that the ground was already prepared for misunderstandings. Perhaps your judgment is correct. In offering my own opinion, in all modesty, I venture to differ because I know the Duke intimately. If you really loved me, she went on, you would realize that I was your first interest. You would be ready to sacrifice these wretched whims of yours. It isn't the money, and it isn't that I'm ashamed of the suburbs. I would live in the Brixton Road, but I want to be the first thing in your life, she faltered, and made an heroic attempt to appear calm. The Duke was genuinely astonished at the outburst, at the defiance that trembled in her tone, at the proximity of tears. Nay, he was scared, and showed it. My dear girl, he began. I'm not your dear girl, she flamed. I will not accept your horrid patronage. I will not allow you to treat quite serious matters, matters that affect my life, as subjects for your amusement. My dearest, he began, but she stopped him. She removed the half circle of diamonds from her finger with deliberation. She said nothing because she was choking. She did not throw it at him because she was a lady and had lived in Portland Place. She laid it on the table and fled. The Duke stood speechless and open-mouthed. He did not behave like a hero. Did Alicia behave like a heroine? A study of contemporary fiction compels me to confess reluctantly that she did not. But this is a true story, and this remarkable scene I have described actually occurred. End of section 30. Section 31 of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Duke Remains, Part 4. Old Joe the First, crowned and confident, was on his throne, and Tuppy was rehearsing him in view of an approaching function. "Draw near us," said Tuppy. "Draw near us," repeated Old Joe pompously. "What ho, varlets! A beaker of wine," coaxed Tuppy. "What ho, varmints!" "Varlets," corrected Tuppy. "What ho!" Just then, the Duke entered, a tragic figure. Old Joe, proud of his accomplishment, spoke his lines. "Ho, noble Duke," he bleated. "Draw near, come down out of that," said the Duke peevishly. "Go into the kitchen." "If," said Old Joe, taking off his crown politely, "I've said anything that's given offense." "Go to the devil," said the Duke. The King retired hurriedly. Not a word was spoken till he had departed, and then, "I'm disengaged," said the Duke bitterly. "My dear old feller," expostulated Tuppy. "I'm disengaged," repeated the Duke, and he looked around for a seat. The throne invited him, and he mounted its wooden steps. "I'm finished," he said, and sat down on Old Joe's abandoned crown. He sprung up with alacrity and flung the bauble away. "Steady with the crown jewels, old man," said Tuppy anxiously. "Hank, the coroner's knocked off. There it is, under your chair. Monty, old owl. Why this introduction of R.E. Morse, Esquire?" In a few gloomy words, the Duke made clear the situation. Fortunately for all concerned, Tuppy's knowledge of women and their ways was encyclopedic. As Tuppy himself confessed, what he didn't know was hardly worth finding. He admitted he was a misogynist. He confessed that his experience had been a bitter one, but he tried, as he said, to think that all elderly ladies were not like the Dowager, and few marriageable girls had the physical strength to chuck a fella down three flights of stairs. "Mind you, old bird," warned Tuppy, "the intention is there, all right. The will to do, being somewhat hampered by an undeveloped muscular development, it follows that my own experience was a unique reply to the Brownian feller who asked, 'What hand in mind went ever paired, what brain alike conceived and dared, what act proved all its thought had been, what will but felt the fleshy screen?' Dear old fellow, as one who's felt the fleshy screen grip me by my neck and the left leg of my trousers, yes, positively and indelicately, the left leg of my trousers, I can answer the Brownian feller. It was a remarkable experience. I nearly wrote an account of it for the Field, but Monty, poor soul, your experience is milder, in fact, though parallel in principle. Metaphorically, you have been scruffed and bagged, and there's only one thing to do," he paused. "Sit it out, my boy. Be aloof, noble, patient, stricken with grief. Go to church on Sunday in deep mourning, start a soup kitchen, and be a good to the poor. That fetches 'em."
"Sure," said Hank.
"There's another way," said Tuppy with enthusiasm, "to be the riotous dog. Stay out late, come home early, sing comic songs, wear soft-fronted dress shirts that emphasize your decadence. Go to the devil ostentatiously. That fetches 'em too."
"Sure," agreed Hank.
"That is easier," said the Duke thoughtfully. "It was all so very unexpected and sudden," he went on, reverting to the tragedy of the evening. "Oh, it always is," said the sympathetic Tuppy. "Take my case. I hadn't time to catch hold of the banisters before." I think the Duke was genuinely distressed. He sat with his head resting on one hand, his brows wrinkled in a frown, his free hand plucking idly at the velvet fringe that ornamented the throne. "I had looked forward to a joyous winter," he said disconsolately. We'd got the brokers in. We might have been evicted by the police. I almost certainly should have gone to Brixton Prison. I'd arranged to borrow Windermere's state carriage and postilions for the occasion, and now the whole scheme is nipped in the bud." They sat in the common room, which in the daytime commanded a view of the tiny garden and toward the darkness which hid, amongst other things, the sacred ladder. Now, alas, purposeless, the Duke shook his clenched fist. "Oh, woe is me," he began, and out of the gloom of the garden leapt a thin spurt of white flame. There was a crash of glass, and a split of wood flew from the gilded back of the throne. Instantly came a stinging report, and the light went out. Hank was in reach of the switch, and Hank moved quickly in emergencies like these. End of section 31.
Section 32 of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace.
This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Duke Returns, Part 5. Mr. Slewer's attack came unexpectedly and found the Duke unprepared. Once before, Mr. Slewer had come to Kaimot Crescent, but his arrival had been noted by the observant Hank, and there had been a raid upon a well-furnished armory. The Duke ran for the conservatory, but Hank's arm caught him. "Not on your life," he murmured. "If that's Bill, he's waiting. Get upstairs, find your gun. Mine's hanging behind the door of my room." He heard the Duke mount the stairs with flying feet and cautiously opened the conservatory door that led to the garden. "You, Bill," he said softly, but there came no answer. Disregarding the sage advice he had given to the Duke, he stepped swiftly into the darkness. He sank down flat on the wet grass and peered left and right. There was no sign of any intruder, but he was too old a campaigner to trust overmuch to first appearances. There was a light step behind him, and he was joined by the Duke. "See anything?" whispered the Duke, and pushed the Colt into his hands. "Nothing," said Hank. "He's gone." Noiselessly, they wiggled the garden length. Hank made for the place where the ladder should have been, but his sweeping arm could not find it. Later, it was discovered against the wall at the end of the garden. Kaimot Crescent is an offshoot of Kaimot Road. If you take the letter Y, the left fork to represent the crescent, and the straight line and right fork to represent Kaimot Road, you may realize the easier how the mysterious assassin escaped. For on the other side of the wall, at the end of the Duke's garden, is a main thoroughfare, deserted at this hour of the night, and it was as simple a matter to gain access to the garden as it was to escape from it. They returned to Tuppy, a preternaturally solemn figure sitting entrenched behind a divan which he had thoughtfully upended. "He's gone," said the Duke cheerfully, but awoke no responsive gleam in Tuppy's eye. "Oh, he's gone, has he?" said Tuppy absently. "Yes, nipped over a ladder. I say, Tuppy, you're not scared?" "Oh, not a bit. Oh, dear, no," replied Tuppy without any great heartiness. "There wasn't any danger, you know." "Well, of course not," said Tuppy. "Quite so." He glanced apprehensively at the shattered glass of the door. "Better put up the shutters, old fellow," he said with a careless wave of his hand. "There's a beastly draft." There was, as it happened, two folding shutters artfully concealed at the side of the door, which Hank closed. Tuppy sighed explosively. "Of course," he said. "A little thing like that wouldn't worry me. To a fellow who has seen ups and downs of life, especially the downs, an incident of this description. Put the bar over that shutter, Hank, old friend. I still feel the draft. An incident of this description is mere child's play." "I think I'll toddle," the Duke protested. "So soon? Oh, rot. Tuppy, stay and make a night of it. I want your invaluable advice, Tuppy. I'm at sixes and sevens." "Oh, not tonight, old boy," said Tuppy. "Got a shucking headache, too much port, liver out of order." They escorted him to his door. Safe inside the portals of his own mansion, Tuffy recovered his spirits. "If the fishing is as exciting as the shooting," he mused out loud, "I've got a hold of a fine sporting estate." End of section 32. Section 33 of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Duke Returns, Part 6. Mr. Naep, the eminent editor, sat before his desk in the editorial offices of The Aristocrat. His long black hair was rumpled, his penholder bore marks of a severe biting. Before him were pigeonholes neatly labeled Government, Attack on, Imperialism and Crime, Comprenez-vous, this was the already famous rival column to On Dit in the rival sheet, New Ideas, Notes for Leader, and similar comprehensive titles. There was a pigeonhole marked Advertisements, but this was empty. Mr. Naep was sore, for the L&L Mail had discovered the identity of the Aristocrat's editor and had referred to him as a peddling crime-monger and a contemptible plagiarist, to say nothing of calling him a pseudo-Holmes. In consequence, he had for 3 days devoted himself to a feverish hunt into the antecedents of Mr. R. B. Rake. He learned that Mr. Rake had, at one period of his career, been engaged as schoolmaster, a peg to hang piggish pedagogue upon, that he drew inspiration for his leaders from Hyde Home, Gregarious Gramophone, that was a gentleman of loud voice and aggressive, self-confident manner, Pomp and Circumstance, wrote Mr. Naep cleverly, and other more or less important items, all of which went into the leader. In truth, Mr. Naep's reply to the slanderous innuendos of the L&L Mail might be described as having been effective and complete. Now, Mr. Naep was in a quandary because he was engaged in a distasteful task. This was none other than the booming of the Tuppy Party, and worst of all, the editing of a letter of apology. It would appear that in the first case, that in honor of our distinguished neighbor, Lord Tupping, Mrs. Stanley Terrell would give a reception at her house, that amongst others the following eminent people would be present: Sir Harry Tanner, the mayor of Brockley, the vicar, Captain Hal Tanner, 9th R. W. Kent's, and others too numerous to mention. Bewildered that the citadel of the Duke's fiancée should shelter the arch-enemy, Mr. Naep had commenced a long and scathing satire entitled The Peer Master, a happy description of Sir Harry, when peremptory orders came for its suppression and a substitution of laudatory notices concurring the forthcoming function. It had required all the Duke's powers of persuasion to induce Tuppy to accept the invitation. "It's a plant," said Tuppy furiously. "It's the old Tanner bird showing off the captive at his chariot's wheel. He's dazed that poor dear lady into giving a party. I'm not going. High Jupiter, devastating Ulysses," he swore. "Did that dear old thing Guy Tuppen go down on the stricken field at Cressy, all mucked about with 200 sword and maces and things for this? Did you cannot escape a tea party by reference to your alleged ancestors," said the Duke calmly. "In the stricken field time of business, Tanner can give you a stone and a beating. Tuppy, you've got to go." So Mr. Naep sat, though his soul revolted, engaged in writing pleasantly and amiably and heartily a forenotice of the reception which was to introduce Lord Tupping to his awe-stricken neighbors. His task was made all the more difficult by the knowledge that already public interest had been aroused in the attempt to jockey the Duke from the suburbs, that letters signed Fair Play and Pro Bono Publico had begun to arrive, that a meeting of the Ratepayers Association had been projected, and that there were not wanting other signs of the Duke's growing popularity in the neighborhood. Mr. Naep had suddenly found himself a political force. He had the satisfaction of knowing that he was behind the scenes. Crowning joy of all, he had been referred to as a wire puller, and had displayed the significant phrase with an affection of nonchalance to Hank. "He means leg puller," said Hank. "Oh, we don't think you treat this matter seriously enough," said Mr. Naep severely. "We have a certain duty to our party, a certain responsibility to our public. The whole district is ripe for change. The job of dismissing the water cart man has roused considerable feeling. The appointment of the workhouse master's son to the position of rate collector is a scandal. People are asking how long, how long?" "How long?" demanded the Duke. "How long?" repeated Mr. Naep. "I mean, how long have they been asking that remarkable question?" Mr. Naep coughed modestly. It coincided with the appearance of our little leaderette on subconscious corruption," he admitted. As to the letter of apology, the Duke silenced criticism with extraordinary brusqueness. The change in the policy of the aristocrat was revolutionary. It affected Mr. Naep dismally. It affected Mr. R. B. Rake, editor of the L&L, staggeringly. It had a paralyzing effect upon the household at Hyde Home. "Now what on earth is the meaning of this?" demanded the knight. He stabbed the newspaper with his short forefinger. The article it referred to was headed "An Open Letter." It began, "To whom I have offended." "Well, that's me, of course," said the knight, and read on. And as he read and reread, he grew more and more bewildered, for this was an apology, an abject, groveling plea for forgiveness. "It is forbidden that I should see you." "Oh, quite right," said Sir Harry. "I told William that under no circumstance he was to admit him." "My letters are returned unopened." Sir Harry smiled grimly. He had received a letter in the Duke's handwriting and had promptly reposted it. "And with every day comes a surer knowledge of my error in opposing your will. It is this realization that has decided me upon my future conduct. You wish me to go away. I will go. You wish me to be more considerate." "Well, I've never said so in so many words," commented the knight. "You desire that I should forego all local ambition and retire to the oblivion from whence I sprang. So be it." "Remarkable," was all that Sir Harry could say. "If I have caused you pain by my presumption—" "Pain," said Sir Harry, and thought of the £60,000. "I am sorry. I return to the wilds, to the illimitable breadth and length of the wilderness, here on some waterless plain where vultures hover in the clear blue sky. Do you know," said Sir Harry helplessly, "do you know, Hal, I really cannot understand this business. I really cannot. Last week he was referring to me as the sort of person who had made England what she was, in quite an objectionable way. He spoke insultingly about the leather trade and referred meaningly to hidebound arrogance. Now it's Tuppy," said Hal. "I knew it would happen. Tuppy is the chap who is working the Oracle. As soon as the idea occurred to me, I said, 'By Jove, that's a corker.'" Sir Harry fixed his pince-nez more firmly on his nose and continued to read. "I have dared too much." "I should jolly well say so," interjected Hal. "I have moved too fast, and I pay the penalty. Our contract is broken." "That's an important admission if he goes into court about the lease," commented Sir Harry over his glasses. "At the appointed time, I will remove myself. Farewell." Sir Harry folded up the paper. He looked at Hal, and Hal looked at him. And then Sir Harry took off his glasses, folded them, and placed them ceremoniously in his waistcoat pocket. "May we say," he queried with majestic calm, "that we have triumphed?" Strangely enough, this open letter inspired the same question in the mind of Alicia Terrell. End of section 33. Section 34 of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Duke Returns, Part 7. Luckily, Mrs. Terrell, by her simple device of opening the folding doors that separated the drawing room from the breakfast room, was able to offer one fair-sized apartment for the accommodation of her guests, built almost identically on the same lines as that occupied by the Duke. Number 66 had been transferred, as the Lewisham and Lee Mail in a breathless article described it, into a veritable bower of roses, equaling in stateliness and expensiveness the most splendid habitations of Belgravia and the West End. It was Hal's idea that the conservatory at the back, and which, as in the Duke's house, was an annex to the breakfast room, should be converted by means of three flags and a red carpet. A lavish display of bunting, said the Lewisham and Lee Mail, into a sort of throne room. Hither Tuppy was conducted. Tuppy was very irritable and very beautiful in his dress kit, and one by one the guests were ushered into the presence. Hal was a self-appointed MC. "Mr. Gosser and Miss Gosser," announced Hal. "Glad to see you. How do you do?" "Mr. James Fenton, Mrs. James Fenton, and Mr. Fenton, Jr." "Happy to meet you. How do you do?" "Mr. Copley, Mr. Minting, Mr. Arthur Brown." "Oh, damn it. How do you do? How do you do?" Wearily, it must be understood that much of Tuppy's greeting was sotto voce. "Miss Sprager, who's a very fine fiddle player." "How do you do? Beastly cold, isn't it?" "Mr. Willie Syme. Brought any songs, Syme?" "Got a shocking cold, old chap. Thank heavens. Glad to meet you, Mr. Syme."
Mrs. Outram. Weird old bird. How are you, Mrs. Outram? Glad to meet you. Mr. R.B. Rake, B.A., the editor of the Lewisham. I am honored to make your acquaintance, my lord, said the boisterous journalist. There is no more pleasing feature in our modern life than the democratizing of the peerage. Noisy devil. How do you do? Glad to meet you. Mrs. Pulser? Mr. Pulser? Miss Pulser? Oh, Lord, how many more of them? Glad to meet you. How do you do? There was scarcely room to move. The guests overflowed into the hall and onto the stairs. Sir Harry, wedged in one corner, surveyed the scene with a glow of pardonable pride. To him, it represented the Duke's coup de grace. Mr. Rake wormed his way through the press of people to his side. Well, sir? Demanded Mr. Rake. He said this in a tone that suggested that he had only omitted, what did I tell you, out of pure politeness. For Mr. Rake had an unpleasant knack of claiming personal credit for all and sundry happenings, from weddings to earthquakes, no matter how little he had to do with their instigation, that had earned him amongst his colleagues the title of Prophet of the Afterwards. This, I think, Mr. Rake went on, effectively settles our friend. Sir Harry nodded. The letter, of course, was the official suicide. This might aptly be described as the wake. Arousing no enthusiasm, he continued, What a remarkable man Lord Tupping is. Yes. So popular. So it appears. Everybody is simply charmed with him. It is Lord Tupping this and Lord Tupping that on every hand. Yes, yes, said Sir Harry indulgently. Tuppy is a good fellow. The good fellow at the moment was expostulating with Hal. Now look here, Tanny, old friend, he said firmly. I'm not going to meet anybody else. I'm sick of this business, and I'm dashed if I'm going to stick in it any longer. It will soon be over, old man, said Hal. We've finished the Duke. Oh, said Tuppy absently. Yes. Didn't you see the letter he wrote to the governor in his rag? No, said the innocent Tuppy. What? Not the bit about the vultures in the air and the brazen sky? Blue sky, corrected Tuppy and went on hastily. I suppose you mean blue, don't you? Blue or brazen, Hal said. It was a lot of infernal rot. My dear old fellow, said Tuppy huffishly, eminent strategist and military authority as you are, incisive analyst of character as you may be, rampant rhetorician and high-stepping logician, as in all probability you imagine yourself to be. I cannot accept your dictum on literary quality or diction. I thought that vulture touch was exceptionally imaginative, and the introduction of the blue sky supremely delicate. Anyone would think that you had written that bit yourself, chafed Hal. Tuppy was not to be appeased. That's beside the question, he complained. And then Alicia interrupted them. She monopolized Tuppy and Hal. After a vain attempt to join in the conversation, withdrew a little sulkily. Lord Tupping, she asked, aren't you feeling a terrible hypocrite? Not unusually so, dear lady, said Tuppy. Sir Harry thinks that you are not on speaking terms with the Duke. Tuppy coughed. At the present moment I ain't, he confessed. It is over a little question as to whether potatoes should be boiled with salt. I say without, but he's a most obstinate beggar lately, since his trouble. Alicia ignored the addition. Who wrote that dreadful letter? She asked suddenly. What letter? Tuppy's face was a blank. Oh, please don't pretend that you are ignorant. That wretched letter full of nonsense. Tuppy drew himself up. Dear lady, he said stiffly, if you refer to the vultures with a woman's quick intuition, she guessed at the authorship of that piece of imagery. No, I am not referring to that portion of the letter, she said tactfully. In fact, I thought that little touch rather fine, she added, inwardly praying for forgiveness. But the letter in general, the whole idea, it was the Duke's, of course. The less imaginative part was the Duke's, confessed Tuppy, the crude outline, so to speak, the framework. Well, she broke in, speaking rapidly, you are to tell the Duke that he must not do such a thing again. I will not receive farewell messages through the public press. Indeed, you may tell him that nothing will induce me to read the paper again. Oh, I say, protested Tuppy. Don't say it. Next week's letter ain't half bad. Next week? Alicia's blood boiled. "Do you mean to tell me that he dares to repeat?" "He's written 20 already," said the informer. "Some of 'em good, some of 'em so-so. There's a very fine one called The Prophets of Penitence that'll appear in the Christmas number. That's a tremendously touching thing about Christmas bells and children dying in the snow." Alicia had no words by now. She gained self-possession with an effort. "You must tell the Duke," she began.
"Well, why not tell him yourself?" suggested Tupley.
Somebody at the far end of the room had just finished singing, and people who had found seats were smiling sweetly at people who were standing. And people who were standing were smiling back and saying "selfish pig" under their breath. So when Sir Harry mounted a chair, and instantly the hum of talk died down. "My friends," said Sir Harry, "I feel that we cannot separate tonight without my saying a few words concerning the object of this gathering." Cheers. "We have met together to do honor to our neighbor, Lord Tupping." Loud cheers. "Heaven and earth," fretted Tupping, "why doesn't he leave me alone?" "Lord Tupping," Sir Harry went on, "has shown us by example the attitude of the typical English peer, dignified yet gracious, reserved yet approachable. He combines generosity with restraint and is a striking contrast to the pseudo-nobleman whose unedifying behavior has, I think I'm right in saying, scandalized our beautiful suburb."
I say, said Tuppy indignantly, but nobody heard him.
"As oil to water," said Sir Harry, "as the genuine is to fictitious, so is the old nobility to the upstart. I should say, so is the English nobility to the foreign. They do not mix. They have nothing in common. Their ideals are separated by an immeasurable gulf. We cannot be but sensible," the knight proceeded, "when there was a commotion at the doorway and a tall man pushed his way through. It was the Duke, hatless, pale, and a little breathless. 'Tuppy,' he called, and so, to Harry's amazement, the object of his panegyric came halfway to meet him. In the silence that fell upon the assembly, every word of the conversation was audible. 'Tuppy, did you come over the garden wall tonight?' was his astounding question.
'No, old fella.'
'Sure?'
'Sure, dear boy.'
The Duke stood thinking. 'Then you didn't drop this,' he said, and held out his hand. It held a silver-mounted cigar case. Sir Harry recognized it with a smothered oath. It was the case he had given to Bill Sluer. 'It is inscribed, Harry Tanner,' said the Duke. 'And the gentleman who dropped it, in his hurry, left me a further token of his regard.' He held up his other hand, and Alicia gave a little cry, for the hand was swathed in a pocket handkerchief, ominously scarlet. End of section 34.
Section 35 of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 5, The Duke Adventures, Part 1. It was nearing the period when something would have to be done. These were Ola Joe's exact words. With an action pending in the High Court, the presence of the broker's man was suggestive rather than conclusive. Ola Joe was a splendid splash of color, a picturesque accessory, but as Tuppy pathetically complained, he had not as yet justified the trouble and the expense. It is true that with a silver salver in his hand he had replaced the sedate servant, that he received visitors and showed them in, that clad in his striking raiment he negotiated with the butcher and the milkman, and that he was one of the sights. More than this, he was admitted into the family circle and was invariably introduced to callers as "my broker's man" or "my possessionist." With Tuppy's coming, the question of Ola Joe became a vital one. Tuppy, it may be said, was now an inmate of 64. A curt note from Sir Harry's solicitors had terminated his tenancy. Supplementary to this was a letter from Sir Harry himself, in which he dealt freely in such phrases
as two-faced duplicity, run with the hare and hunt with the hounds, betrayal of a sacred trust, and similar happily coined phrases of opprobrium. "The perfectly horrible thing is," Tuppy said, in bitterness of spirit, "I've given up my flat in Charles Street, and it's 1,000 to 30 the landlord won't take me back again unless I pay something off the old account." The Duke pressed him to stay, and Hank was extremely urgent in his invitation. "The Duke should surely have somebody he can talk blighted hopes to," he said, in his capacity as an authority on women. Tuppy stayed. Thus, Olajo came to be a problem, for Tuppy brought the faithful Bolt, and No. 64 was not built for the accommodation of a house party. Olajo, therefore, became the pivot around which revolved a ceaseless whirl of discussion. He was a domestic crisis. Something must be done with Olajo. This was the beginning and the end of the agenda under review. Olajo was present at the most important of these. From time to time he interjected expostulatory noises. "A Johnny man that I know," said Tuppy reminiscently. "I don't exactly know him, but I owe his brother 100, which, to all intents and purposes, extends my acquaintance, because if I don't know him, he is pretty sure to have heard about me from the brother fellow, who's a deuce of a bleeder about money affairs." "I'll look him up in the Dictionary of National Biography," said the Duke. "In the meantime, this man used to go to the wooliest places, Africa and Klondike and similar horrid spots outside the radius, used to go bug hunting and lion fishing and bee stalking. And when he got something extra in the way of skins or wings or feathers, he used to send it to Ward's, have it stuffed and stuck up in his library. When I say library, I mean the place he used to sleep in on Sunday afternoons. But if he got something extra, something stupendously gapish, such as a pink lion or a sky-blue rattlesnake, something absolutely priceless, he used to give it to some dashed museum. There was insanity in the family, mind you." The Duke cast a calculating glance at Olajo. "Well, we might leave him at the South Kensington," he mused. "Stuffed?" suggested Hank. "In a box," said Tuppy enthusiastically, "with a ripping big label on the top, a present to the nation from the true friend, or some rot like that." "Or, in lieu of conscience money," said the Duke, "from two who have robbed the Inland Revenue, asking Finder to notify the same in the Times newspaper." "Gents," said Olajo with a forced smile, "foreigners I've always been obliging to without the word of a lie. Organ grinders, ice cream blokes, and ladies who tell your fortunes with little dicky birds, what pick a bit of paper out of the box to tell you whether your husband will be dark or fair, and how many children you're going to have. If you treat others well, you can expect to be treated well yourself. Do unto others as thyself would be done is a saying old and true. So, no larks, if you please." "When you started that interesting exposition on tolerance of the alien," said Tuppy aggrieved, "I was under the impression you were going to say something particularly apposite." "No larks," confirmed Olajo. "Say," said Hank suddenly, "what's the matter with sending him to the Tanner guy?" "Alive?" asked Tuppy in a matter-of-fact tone that made Olajo shiver. "Why, sure. Send him along with a big tag tied to his coat. It's getting round about the festive season when you give away things you've no use for." "I feel certain," said the Duke, "that Olajo could be used for some wise purpose. An age that has found employment for byproducts in general should not be at a loss for using up this variety. The difficulty about the knight is that he's going abroad." "Abroad?" "Abroad. Whether that means a season in the Riviera or an exploration in the Sandwich Islands, I cannot say, but abroad he's going. Or gone." "Well, we could send our dear old friend as a courier, a sort of unofficial dragoman," questioned Tuppy. But the Duke shook his head. "The situation is this," he said. "We take a house. The knight buys out our landlord. We refuse to pay rent. The knight puts a broker's man in. We're tired of the broker. We've no room for the broker. He has outlived his usefulness. Question, what should A do with B?" "We might, of course, bury him in the garden," the Duke went on, "thus enriching the soil. We might wait for a foggy night and take him out and lose him." "Monty, I've got it." The inspiration had come to Tuppy with extraordinary suddenness. "Pay him out." "What?" "Pay the rent," said Tuppy. "It's unusual in cases like this, and it's bad precedent, but as a solution, it's got points you could hang your hat on."
End of section 35. Section 36 of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Duke Adventures, Part 2. It is a fault of some authors that they persistently refuse to introduce characters into their stories unless those characters, in the course of the narrative, perform an act or acts of such transcendent importance as to make the story impossible without their presence. Accordingly, we are familiar with the faithful servant who meanders through 300 pages with little to say for himself save, "Dinner served, Your Grace," or "His lordship has not yet returned from hunting, milady," who is deliciously obscure until the end of the book, when he gives his life for the children, or produces the missing will. We know of governesses, pretty and otherwise, who are the merest shadows for 20 chapters, but enter into their kingdom in the 21st when they accuse the earl of unblemished character of being the father of the beggar boy. I could have wished that Ola Joe might have passed from these pages naturally and without fuss, such as people pass from the real pages of life, without ostentation, noiselessly ignoring the rules of the theater, which demand that no character shall leave the stage without an effective line to take them off, such as, "We meet tomorrow," or "Look at Sir George, look at," or in the case of more important figures, a long and heroic peroration. The rules of the theater do not insist upon heroics for a part like Ola Joe's. I think something like this would have fulfilled all requirements. Ola Joe, one foot on the doorstep, bundle slung over his shoulder. "Farewell, my lord, farewell, my noble duke. The elms shall bud to greeny leafness, and the summer sun shall gild the cupola of this great house. I pass to winter, to an endless night, bereft of your bright presence. For this gold, this token of your grace, my charged heart puts lock upon my tongue." Some business with a handkerchief. "Farewell." There were, as it happened, certain lines to be said by Ola Joe in the natural course of events, for the broker's man shares with the waiter, the boots, the chambermaid, and the hotel porter the same characteristic and absolute repugnance to effacement. The bailiff's receipt lay on the table, and Ola Joe, in a ducal coat, a lordly pair of trousers, and a cowboy hat, the united contributions of the household, took the handsome tip that Duke had delicately slipped into his hand. Tearful eyes expressed his gratitude. "Gents all," said Ola Joe, who had little knowledge of and regard for the stateliness of blank verse. "Gents all," said Ola Joe, who had little knowledge of and regard for the stateliness of blank verse. "As a man to man, I'm obliged to you. If I've done anything that I oughtn't have done, I ask you your pardon. I've had me duty to do, and I've done the same to the best of my ability. I've always found you to be gentlemen, and if anyone says contrary, it'll be like water on a duck's back, in at one ear and out at the other. If I can ever do you a turn, as far as lays in me power, I'm ready and willing, and with these few remarks I thank you, one and all," which was a highly creditable speech. So passed Ola Joe, and I would that no further necessity existed for introducing him again so that I might emphasize my protest against convention in art. "The house will now go into committee," said the Duke, "on a purely personal matter. Hank, I'm feeling most horribly worried." "If it's that eternal feminine woman," said Hank, rising quickly, "as I've got a hunch it is, you'll find me in the back lot planting snowdrops." "You're beastly, unsympathetic," complained the indignant Duke. "Here are two loving heart—" "Anatomy," said Hank in the doorway, "is a science I've no love for since the day the Dago doctor of Apothecus Mex amputated my little toe under the mistaken impression that ptomaine poisoning was something to do with the feet." "Well, what we've got to do now," said Tuppy, when the unromantic Hank had disappeared, "is to get something particularly touching. I'm afraid I've spoilt the other letters, but unintelligently anticipating the contents—" "What an ass you were, Tuppy," said the Duke testily, and Tuppy cheerfully agreed. For 2 hours they sat composing the wonder-working epistle. "To whom it may concern," it was addressed, and began, "What is life?" says Emerson. "Oh, that's a fool's start," said Tuppy. "Why drag an old man, Emerson, anyway?" "Can you suggest a better?" asked the Duke tartly. "What's the matter with this?" asked Tuppy. "You know, the Tennyson stuff." He knit his forehead in the effort to remember, and then he recited, filling in the blanks as well as he could, "It's jolly true, tum-tum befall, I feel it, tum-tum-tum-tum most.
it's better to have loved a gal than never to have loved at all.
That's rotten, said the Duke.
I don't think I quite have the lines right, said Tuppy, but any fella can see the drift of the thing.
If I ever write poetry, Tuppy, said the Duke, I should be very grateful if you would refrain from quoting it. The Emerson opening was allowed to stand. Tuppy made another determined effort to introduce a flower of poetry into the letter when it was nearing completion.
Look here, Monty. Why not work in that bit about love to a girl is a thing apart, 'tis a fellow's whole existence?
Partly, said the Duke, out of respect for the dead whom you are misquoting, it runs, love to a man is a thing in part.
She wouldn't know the difference, said the Sanguine Lord. That's beside the question. This is supposed to be an open letter addressed to Sir Harry. I can't chuck words of poetry at his unfortunate head. After all, he's been punished enough.
They broke off their composition to join Hank in the garden, whilst the sedate servant laid the table for lunch. So far from planting snowdrops, Hank had established himself in the little greenhouse at the end of the garden, a warm, cozy little greenhouse on a wintry day, and ensconced in a deck chair, had fallen asleep. They woke him by the simple expedient of opening the door wide and letting in a rush of icy cold air.
"Notice anything strange about next door?" yawned Hank, and the Duke started.
"No, no," he replied with a shade of anxiety. "What is it?"
"Blinds down, shutters up, general air of desolation," enumerated Hank.
The Duke looked quickly and raced into the house. The sedate servant, his name was Cole, was folding a serviette.
"Cole," said the Duke sternly, "where are the people next door?"
Gone, my lord, said Cole.
Gone, gone. When did they go? Where have they gone? And why on earth was I not told?
They went last night, my lord. They have gone to Bournemouth, if I'm accurately informed. My source of information is the butcher.
The postman would have been better, said the Duke reprovingly.
The postman is an extremely reticent person, and moreover is a radical who does not approve of us, said Cole.
The butcher, on the other hand, stands for landed interest and the established church.
Excellent, said the Duke. Proceed. They left last night, Cole went on, dealing with the questions in order, which accounts for the fact that I did not inform your grace, information having arrived with the chops 10 minutes ago.
Cole paused deferentially and then continued. If your grace will remember, I suggested a joint for today's lunch, a suggestion which was not acceptable. Had it been a leg of mutton, your grace would have been informed 2 hours ago, the joint requiring that extra time to cook, and the butcher in consequence calling earlier.
You're vindicated, Cole, said the Duke. As they disposed of the dilatory chop at lunch, the Duke was exceptionally quiet.
I don't know why they've gone away, he said, but I'm not so sure that their departure isn't providential.
My mind was running on the same set of rails, said Hank. He pushed back his plate and produced a cigar.
Duke, it's about time we settled Big Bill for good and all.
Oh, don't tell me, said Tuppy hastily, that your shooting friend is in the neighborhood?
Hank nodded slowly.
Here last night, wasn't he, Dukey?
He was, said the Duke absently.
We traced his little footsteps in the garden bed, said Hank.
But my dear foolish transatlantic cousin, protested Tuppy. The police, old friend, the dashed custodians of public peace and order. What the deuce do you pay rates and taxes and water rates and gas bills for?
The police, Hank smiled.
Oh, the police are all right, but there's nothing doing with the police. This is a feud for private circulation only.
But, cried Tuppy, violently and unpleasantly excited, it's distinctly unfair to our splendid constabulary. You oughtn't to be selfish, old fellow. Suppose this horrid person with his unsporting revolver killed me.
Oh, you can laugh, dear bird, but it'd be deuced unpleasant for me.
Oh, I'm not laughing, Tuppy, said the Duke. I can quite understand your funk.
My good dear, misguided and altogether uncharitable friend, said Tuppy, greatly pained. It isn't funk. I'm notoriously rash, as a matter of fact.
Why, my discharge was suspended from being rash and hazardous. They were the official receiver's own words. No, it isn't funk. It is inherited respect for the law.
He was considerably ruffled.
Well, let me say that I can appreciate your law-abiding spirit, said the Duke. But as Hank said, this isn't a case for the police. It's a purely personal matter between Mr. Slewer and myself. But because the beggar is getting overbold, it is necessary to clip his wings. This is our opportunity. It was at this point that Olajo made his reappearance. Cole announced him, and the Duke, somewhat astonished, ordered him to be brought in. He entered, smiling somewhat vacantly, and stood unsteadily by the door, holding his hat in his hand. A friend's a friend, he said thickly. And a friend in need is a friend in deed, he smiled benevolently. There's them, he said with a sneer, that don't believe all they hear and only half of what they see. There's them that wouldn't believe people could be crowned and sat on a throne at all. His smile became indulgent. Me and a friend of mine, he went off at an angle, not exactly a friend, but a chap I know, went up to the West End. His name was Harry. Ola Joe, said the Duke, sternly, go home. Half a moment, said Ola Joe. I'm coming to the part that will knock you out. Do you know the White Drover outside Victoria Station? It's a house I seldom use, but Harry does. So we went in. Well, I gathered that much, said the Duke. What's yours, says Harry. No, I says, it's my turn, what's yours? No, says Harry, I'll pay, what's yours? No, I says, cut it out, pleaded Hank, forget it. When I heard a chap speaking in the next bar, a private bar with a red velvet seat, an American chap he was, like Hank. It is a proof of Old Joe's exhilaration that he said Hank calmly and coolly and without a blush. He says, the American chap, I'm laying for Dookie. And the other fella, I'll tell you his name in a minute, it comes as a terrible surprise to you, says, do nothing yet, just like that. Do nothing yet. I've got an idea, said this chap, not the American chap, that when this Duke person finds my niece has gone with us to Morocco. To Morocco? Queried the Duke eagerly. To Morocco, repeated Ola Joe, the same place as the leather. When he finds I've persuaded my niece, I'll tell you who she is in a minute, I'm keeping that back to the last, when he finds I've took my niece for a holiday to Morocco, the chances are, says the old boy, he'll come after her. Now, if the Duke goes to Morocco, says the chap, you'll never guess his name, not if you guess for a million years. If the Duke goes to Morocco, I don't care a damn what you do in Morocco. Tuppy, said the Duke quickly, you can stay out of this business if you like. If you come in, there'll be no risk and a lot of amusement. Will you come? Like a shot, said Tuppy. No, you'd never guess, Ola Joe was saying. We've time to pack and catch the 220 from Cannon Street. Just take a few things. We can buy what we want in Paris. They made a rush from the room. You'd never guess, Ola Joe rambled on with closed eyes and swaying slightly, who the old fellow was and who the young lady was. Now, with heavy jocularity, I'll give you three guesses. He was still talking when the door slammed behind the adventurers. End of section 36. Section 37 of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace. This is a LibriVox recording and is in the public domain. The Duke Adventures, Part 3. There are limitations even to the powers of dukes. For instance, even a duke starting forth at 2:30 to catch the 2:20 from Charing Cross is hardly likely to succeed unless he performs one of those miracles of which one hears in the course of destructive and pessimistic parliamentary debate, to wit, put back the hands of time. There was time to shop and time to reflect, time also to wire to the sedate Cole and give instructions for the management of the house during the Duke's absence. It gave Mr. Bill Sluwer time also to discover the Duke's plans, and the Duke's instructions to Cole had included a counsel of frankness as to his whereabouts. The party left London by the 9 o'clock train, the same continental that Hank had flagged, and the crossing from Dover to Calais was a pleasant one to Tuppy's infinite relief. They arrived in Paris before daybreak and idled away that day and the next. The tanners were in Paris, if report was true. The work of investigation was to be divided. You do the magazines, Tuppy, said the Duke. If you hang around the shopping center, you're pretty sure to spot them. The Duke haunted the Louvre. Hank systematically went through the hotel lists. Tuppy, after spending 10 minutes examining the contents of a jeweler's shop window in the Rue de la Paix, came back to the hotel thoroughly exhausted. By accident, they learned that the tanners had gone on to Madrid, and there was a wild rush to catch the Sud Express. They caught it by the narrowest of margins. At Bordeaux, Tuppy got out to buy some French papers, by the merest chance met a man he knew, exchanged greetings and inquiries, spoke rudely of the Dowager. The Sud Express was halfway to the border before Tuppy realized that he ought to have been on it. Accordingly, there was a day lost in Biarritz, where the chafing Duke waited for Tuppy to catch up. In Madrid, They had no difficulty in finding out that the Tanners had arrested their progress at Avilla. Back to the walled city dashed the adventurers. As their train came clanging into the station, the southbound express drew out and the Duke caught a glimpse of Alicia's slim figure standing at the window of a saloon and swore. They returned to Madrid the same night by a train that stopped at every station and sometimes between stations. It discharged them, weary, bedraggled, and extremely cross, at the Medina in the middle of the night. Hank alone of the trio was imperturbable. Nothing shook the nerves or disturbed the serenity of the American. His inevitable cigar between his teeth, he surveyed the chill desolation of the dreary terminus with bland benevolence. It was Tuppy's fault that they missed the Sevilla Express. Tuppy, acquiring a sudden and passionate love for art, strayed through the Prado, lingered in the Velázquez room, melted into a condition of ecstatic incoherence before the wonders of Titian, the glories of Rubens, and the beauty of Paul Veronese, and finally contrived to get himself locked in at closing time. He was discovered by a watchman, pounced upon as an international burglar, arrested, and finally released after considerable trouble in which the British ambassador, the Minister of Marine, and the Duke were involved. "It is no use your being angry, my dear old ferocious friend," said the penitent Tuppy. "Unfortunate as my intrusion to the realms of art may be, I merely illustrate the saying of that remarkable German fellow who wrote a play about the devil, that art is long and time's deuced short, and dear old Titian and cheery old Velázquez wait for no man. My dear man, you had a timetable. Assure you, old fellow, I hadn't, but I gave you one, the little red book." "Oh, so you did," said Tuppy. "A little red book with egg marks. Now, do you know," he said in a burst of confidence, "I didn't know that dashed thing was a timetable." "What the dickens did you think it was?" asked the Duke, in tones of annoyance. "A set of sleeve links?" Thenceforward, Tuppy behaved like a perfect gentleman. The Duke went further and said that Tuppy behaved like a perfect nuisance. For if a train was due to leave at 7, and breakfast was ordered at 6 o'clock, you might be sure that somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 a.m., Tuppy would thrust his head into the Duke's apartment with an anxious inquiry. "Time's a-bouncing, old fellow, what?" he would ask. "I hear people moving downstairs. Are you quite sure about that train?" "For goodness sake, Tuppy, go to sleep," said the Duke on one occasion. And Tuppy withdrew, but not to slumber. Tuppy would begin packing. You could hear Tuppy's boots falling on the bare floor of the Spanish hotel. You could hear Tuppy's apologetic, "Damn!" And then he whistled softly and with heartbreaking flatness, the soldiers' chorus. And then he took a stealthy bath, blowing like a grumpus, and with a sibilant hissing that suggested an ostler in his toilet. Then there came from his room a squeaking and a grunting as Tuppy manipulated his physical developer, and then a thunderous crash as the dumbbells fell to the floor. At this point, the Duke would rise and address feeling remarks to his friend. "Such a program as I have outlined is faithfully typical of what happened in Cordova, in Seville, in Ronda, in Algeciras, and in Gibraltar." It was at Ronda that the Duke came up with his quarry. Alicia, breakfasting alone in the airy little commodore of the station hotel, saw a shadow fall across the doorway but did not look up from the book she was reading. When she did, she met the smiling eyes of the Duke and half rose with outstretched hands. Of course, it was only an unconscious impulse, but it was unnecessary to go halfway with the Duke. He greeted her as though they had parted but yesterday, the best of friends. He had the valuable gift of taking up where he had left off. You never saw the joint in Duke's friendship. Alicia thought rapidly. After all, one cannot offer one's hand and snatch it instantly back again. It had been foolish of her, unmaidenly perhaps, indiscreet no doubt, but here she was, chatting gaily with the Duke. We left Mother in Paris. My aunt is with us. We've had a most perfect weather. She noticed that she was Miss Terrell to him. There was a negative satisfaction in that. So apparently he had not picked up the threads as they had dropped. Also, he made no reference to their parting interview, offered no explanations, was neither tragic nor mournful, displayed, in fact, none of those interesting symptoms which usually distinguish the young man of blighted hopes. He was the most unconventional man Alicia had ever met. The interview had its embarrassing side, as Alicia suddenly remembered. "My uncle will be down very soon," she said suddenly. "I don't think that you and he are quite..." She left the Duke to finish the sentence. He rose. "We aren't quite," he said. I shall probably see you again, she smiled. She was perfectly self-controlled, serenely mistress of herself in the situation. Sir Harry has read your open letters. I think he was touched by your abasement, she said maliciously, and I cannot help thinking incautiously. Naturally, said the Duke calmly, even an uncle has his feelings. To know that his niece has inspired... Goodbye, she said hurriedly. Perhaps it would be better if you didn't see me again, she added inconsistently. We are going on to Tangier tomorrow. By Algeciras or by Cadiz? Queried the Duke. By Algeciras and Gibraltar, said Alicia. Goodbye. She held out her hand nervously. The Duke took it and kissed it. Oh, cried Alicia. The Duke looked surprised. What is the matter? He asked and stroked his cheek. I'm shaven. How dare you? She said hotly. Dare? The Duke was puzzled. Why, aren't you engaged to me? You know I'm not. You know I've returned your hateful ring. You know... The Duke stopped her with an imperious gesture. As to that matter, he said graciously, will you accept my assurance that I have entirely overlooked it? Please, never mention it again. He left her with a confused feeling that somehow, and in some manner, she was under an obligation to him. End of section 37. Section 38 of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Duke Adventures, Part 4. El Mogreb, Alaska, that enterprising sheet, duly announced the arrival of the Duke's party. Unfortunately, said the journal, one member of the Duke's entourage, the Right Honorable the Lord Tupping, was left behind at Gibraltar through some mistake as to the hour of the sailing of the Jebel Musa, from which it may be gathered that Tuppy had fallen from grace. He came on by the next boat, 2 days later, with a tentative grievance. That is to say, it was a grievance that he was prepared to withdraw in the absence of any reproach on the part of the Duke. Tuppy had been spending a day with a friend, who was deputy adjutant something or other to the forces. I didn't mistake the hour, Monty, old fellow, he explained eagerly. I was down on the dashed pier with all my traps, gazing pensively at the lapping waves and the seagulls circling on the rigid pinions and all that, waiting for you, when it occurred to me that you were a deuced long time coming. So I drove to your hotel and found you'd left the day before. They sat in the big hall of the Continental Hotel. From the narrow street without came the sing-song intonation of a young Islam at its lessons, and the pattering of laden donkeys. Tuppy talked to the Duke, but was looking elsewhere. Hank had found some countrywomen of his, and surrounded by all that was best and beautiful in Ohio, was solemnly narrating for the especial benefit of purely fanciful description of a Moorish harem. One face in that circle attracted Tuppy, strangely. And then there's the laundry wife who does the washing, and the cook wife who does the cooking, and the washing up wife, and the sock wife who darns the socks. Oh, Mr. Hanky, you're jollying us. No, sir, Hank said firmly. When I was American minister at Fez in 82, Tuppy's explanations having been satisfactorily exploited, the Duke listened with amusement to the procession of unfounded statements Hank was leading forth for the benefit of the fair Americans. Do you know, Mr. Hanky, said one suddenly, we really don't believe a word you're saying. For one thing, I'm sure you was never the favorite of the Sultan, or we should have read about it in the New York Sunday papers. And I'm certain you never married a Sultan's daughter, Fatima, because you'd just be ashamed to confess it to a lot of nice American girls. You're just a newcomer like the American we met on the Fez Road who asked our guide where the nearest beer hall was. A shriek of laughter greeted this innocent jest. Hank sat up. His lazy voice became immediately incisive. On the Fez Road? An American? Well, he was a man with white eyes, said a voice. Oh, Mamie, how unkind. Still, his eyes did look white. Hank shot a swift glance at the Duke, and the latter nodded. Well, I suppose, drawled Hank, it would be a mighty improper question to ask where this freedom citizen of God's country is staying in Tangier. But nobody knew. They had met the man by accident. They had seen him once in the great sock. With more than this, they could not say. Hank had picked up a servant, none other than Rabbit. Rabbit is a well-known figure in Tangier society,
a waif of the streets, a bravo, an adventurer. A most amusing child of nature was this rabbit, so called because of a certain facial resemblance to Bunny. It may be said of Rabbit that he disobeyed most commands of the prophet. He drank, he gambled, and was on friendly terms with the Giaour. Nonetheless, he rose at inconvenient hours of the night, tucked a praying carpet under his arm, and hied him to his orisons. Rabbit had curious likes and dislikes. He was not everybody's man. His world had two names. The world that treated him well and to whom he attached himself was Mr. Goodman. The world repugnant had a name which had no exact equivalent in the English language, but which in German would be Mr. Shameless Dog Burning a Pitch and Consigned to the Underworld. Hank was the time being his Mr. Goodman, and to Rabbit, Hank delegated the task of discovering Bill. Rabbit discharged his task in 3 minutes. His procedure was simple. He strolled to the marketplace and found a small boy in tattered jellab and very industriously kicking another small boy. Having impartially smacked the heads of both, he sent them on their errand of discovery. And then he went off to sleep. In an hour's time, Rabbit presented himself before Hank in a picturesque condition of exhaustion and reported that Mr. Bill Sluwer was staying at a little hotel near the Casbah. It was not exactly a hotel, said Rabbit frankly, but a house of experience where strangers threw a main with fate. The difficulty with Bill will be his unexpectedness, said the Duke. There is no place in the world more suitably situated for the springing of a surprise than Tangier. Where's Tuppy? He asked. Oh, Tuppy has found an ideal, said Hank. Something worshipful. Did I introduce you to that pretty little girl from Drayton, Ohio? Well, you introduced me to several pretty little girls from Drayton, Ohio, said the Duke. I mean the one that talks. The Duke drew a long breath. The description is inadequate, he said. Do you mean the one that sometimes doesn't talk? Hank ignored the slight to his kindred. The curious thing about it is that she hasn't a dollar, and Tuppy knows it. Her father is just a plain American gentleman with a contempt for millionaires. I doubt if his capital value runs into six figures. Dollars, I mean. Have you been matchmaking? Asked the Duke severely, and Hank blushed. I've no use for lords and such like foolishness, he confessed, but Tuppy has possibilities. His declaration in Tuppy's favor coincided with one made by that worthy on his own behalf. He had, at little trouble, secured an introduction to the laughing girl who had acted as Hank's interlocutor. Now, on the back of a gaily caparisoned mule, he was returning from an excursion to the suburbs, and the girl who rode the donkey at his side was listening demurely, whilst Tuppy spoke upon his favorite subject, which was Tuppy. You must understand, Miss Boardman, he said, that mine is a blighted life. I'm a piece of humanity's flotsam, a pathetic chunk of wreckage on the sea of human existence. Oh, no, Lord Tuppy, murmured the girl. It's true, said Tuppy gloomily. Saddled by rank and bridled by circumstance, this was his pet figure, I've been outdistanced and outfaced in the marathon of life. My whole nature, naturally pure and confiding, has been warped and distorted by a variety of conditions, and even the early grave to which I would extend a fervent welcome. Steady, you beast, he jerked back the reins of his prancing mule, readjusted his hat and eyeglass, and proceeded. The merciful dissolution for which I yearned was denied me and doomed me to tread the thorny path that leads to oblivion. I'll knock your head off if you don't keep quiet. Doomed to stalk, if I may use the expression. A sad shadow amidst the laughing throng, I've become a wretched, embittered creature. Oh, no, Lord Tupping, dissented the girl. Sometimes, Tuppy proceeded recklessly, I am in such a dashed, horridly low state that I don't care what happens. When I would gladly change places with a fellow's going out to war and all that sort of thing. I did volunteer for the Boer War, but my stupid man forgot to post the letter. Oh, how splendid, said the girl with eyes sparkling. Have you ever been to war, Lord Tupping? Not exactly to war, said Tuppy carefully. In the wars, yes, but not to war. Earlier in the afternoon, he had gently broken to her the story of his misalliance. I was a boy at the time, and she was a prima donna. He could not bring himself to own up to a strong woman. We parted practically at the church door, he went on, with a melancholy relish. Information came to me that she was already married. I dropped her, or rather, I gave her the opportunity of dropping me.
Oh, how chivalrous. It must have been a painful experience.
It was, said Tuppy, emphatically. More painful for me than for her.
They threaded a way through the crowd in the great sock.
Now, Miss Boardman, said Tuppy, you know all that is to be known about me. I've told you, he said moodily, more than I've ever told any fellow.
Tuppy believed, when he said this, that he was speaking the truth. It was the surest sign of his confidence and friendship that he added to the history of his life, a history filed in most newspaper offices and which appeared at regular intervals in the New York journals, indeed, every time that the strong lady changed her husband, the assurance that he had told his hearer more than he had ever told anybody else. In this, Tuppy was not singular. But to the girl at his side, it was all very new and all very, very tragic, and there were tears in her eyes as her cavalier led the way down the hill to the town. In spite of his confidence, she was ill-prepared for the proposal that followed. It was after dinner, when the cool breezes of the Atlantic made life bearable, when the sea was bathed in moonlight and the shadowy Spanish hills bulked mistily on the ocean's rim, that Tuppy declared himself. "Miss Boardman," he said suddenly, they were watching the sea from the terrace of the Cecil, "do you know I'm nearly a beggar, broke to the wide, unsympathetic world, up to my neck in debt?" The attack was sudden, and the girl was alarmed. "Lord Tuppy, I'm sorry," she stammered. "Oh, that's all right," said Tuppy easily. "Don't let that worry you. But I wanted to tell you. And there's another startling statement I want to make. I've been talking with your father." "Have you?" faltered the girl. "Well, I have," said Tuppy firmly. "I asked him straight out if he was one of those millionaires that grow as thick as huckleberries in America." For a moment, only the girl suspected his motive. "I was frank with him," said Tuppy. "So deuced frank that he nearly chucked me out the window, but wiser counsels prevailed, as dear old Milton says, and he listened, Miss Boardman. You're not rich." She made no reply. "So that's why I'm going to ask you to come and share a £90 a year baronial castle in the suburbs of London. I've got a little income, enough to pay the rent and buy a library subscription. Will you take me?" All this Tuppy said with an assumption of firmness that he was far from feeling. "There's nothing in me," he said. I'm a reed and a rotter." "Oh, indeed, you mustn't say that," she pleaded. "I am," said Tuppy resolutely. "I am a long worm that has no turning, but I offer you the homage of my declining years. Is it a bet?" His voice shook. Tuppy was ever ready to be stirred by his own emotions. "The title ain't much good to you, and it ain't much good to me," he said. "It's a barren possession, an unpawnable asset that has come unsullied through the ages. I offer it to you," his voice broke, "for what it is worth." She accepted him. Whereupon, I believe, Tuppy broke down, and they wept together. End of section 38. Section 39 of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Duke Adventures, Part 5. Sir Harry Tanner had one admirable British quality. He had a supreme contempt for the foreigner. If the foreigner happened to be, moreover, of dusky hue, Sir Harry's scorn was rendered more poignant by a seasoning of pity. He was totally fearless of all danger. He had never been in danger, except once when he slipped up on a banana skin outside the mansion house and had all but fallen under an omnibus. Thereafter, Sir Harry was the avowed enemy of the banana industry and had carried his prejudice to the extent of refusing to underwrite a Jamaica loan. Danger with bullets in it, danger garnished with shrapnel, danger, indeed, of the cut and the thrust order, he knew nothing about, and was accordingly genuinely amused when the British Vice Consul advised him not to venture too far from the city. "There's Valentini among the Riffes, and El Amet playing round with the Angera people, and 1,001 cutthroats wandering about, robbing each other," said the official. "Altogether, it is fairly unsafe to move out of Tangier without an escort." Sir Harry smiled tolerantly. "Thanks," he said airily. "It's very proper of you, of course, to warn me. You've got to protect your department, but I'm quite able to look after myself. If it comes to fighting," he chuckled, nodding at Hal, "we've a fellow here who can teach these rascals a thing or two."
Lieutenant Hal Tanner of the 9th West Kent remarked modestly that there were one or two dodges he could show them. So in spite of all warning, Sir Harry rode out on the Fez Road with Alicia on his left and the military gentleman on his right, and two mules bearing, respectively, a cold collation and Mahmud Ali, that magnificent courier, guide, interpreter, and bodyguard, behind them. It was not as pleasant a ride as Alicia had anticipated. Sir Harry was not in his very best mood, and Hal was sulky. An unexpected meeting for Sir Harry, who had not dreamt that the Duke would so completely fulfill his prophecy. With some vague misgivings, Sir Harry remembered certain conversations with Bill Sluer. He had been vexed at the time, and had perhaps spoken hastily and foolishly. He recalled dimly an historical parallel. A king had once said in his anger, "Will nobody rid me of the turbulent priest?" And straightway, four rollicking spirits had driven over to Canonbury, or was it Canterbury, and sliced off the head of a worthy bishop, Cardinal Wolsey, or somebody of that sort. These thoughts filled his mind as his Arab barb trotted through the sand. In his annoyance, he had accused Alicia of encouraging the Duke to follow her, and she had indignantly denied it. Hal, rashly coming to the support of his father, had been entirely and conclusively squashed. So three people rode forth on a picnic, harboring uncharitable thoughts toward the Duke de Montvilliers. Sir Harry's wrath was tinctured with fear because of Big Bill Sluer of Four Ways, Texas. Hal's anger was inflamed by jealousy, for he was in love with his cousin. Alicia's annoyance was directed against the Duke because he had been the cause of her embarrassment. Was Bill Sluer in Tangier? Sir Harry had sent the imposing Mahmud Ali to inquire, but Mahmud Ali had no familiars, as Rabbit had, and the answer he brought to his employer was unsatisfactory. They rode in silence for an hour, with no sign of the enemy the vice-consul had foreshadowed. Alicia was in ignorance of that interview. Sir Harry had not deemed the conversation sufficiently interesting to repeat. And when they had reached the little hill whereon lunch was to be taken, he unbent. Possibly a pint of excellent champagne was responsible for his garrulity. "Danger?" said Alicia, looking nervously about. "Oh, uncle, what a ridiculous thing to say." "So I said, my dear," said Sir Harry. "With Gibraltar a stone's throw away, and a British fleet to be had for the asking, it is all bosh to talk about danger." "That is what I said, Governor," corrected Hal. "I pointed out that Morocco is in too dicky a position to fool about with British subjects. Now who the devil is this?" His last words were addressed to nobody in particular, and Alicia followed the direction of his gaze. Over a sandy ridge, 2 miles away, pranced two horsemen. Pranced is the word, for that is the impression they conveyed. Hal, who was no fool despite all contrary views that might be held, knew that they were galloping pretty hard. "They're making straight for us," said Sir Harry, and his face was a little pale. He jumped up and gave an order to the guide. "Pack these things up as quick as you can," he ordered. "We can't be too careful." He raised his glasses and fixed them on the riders, and then he swore. "That damned Duke," he said, and heard a long-drawn sigh behind him where Alicia stood. "Duke?" muttered Sir Harry. "Confound the fellow, I thought it was a... Well, never mind. Who's the other man?" "Who?" snorted Hal. "Who could it be, Governor, but the Yankee person?" "Hmm," said Sir Harry. He was surprised to find that he did not resent the coming of his enemy as much as he thought he should. He bowed stiffly as the two drew rein and was ready to be conveniently distant and polite, but he was unprepared for the Duke's greeting. "What the dickens do you mean by coming out so far?" demanded the Duke angrily. "How dare you expose Alicia to this danger?" "Sir," said the outraged knight. "Get up. Get up on your horses," commanded the Duke unceremoniously, and like children they obeyed. Alicia stole a look at her lover. She experienced a shock. His face was set and white, just as she had seen it twice before. There were rigid lines about his mouth and face, and his underjaw was thrust forward so that his whole face was transformed. "Trot," he said shortly, and they began their journey homeward. Now and again Hank would turn in his saddle and look earnestly backward. "Have you any arms?" asked the Duke suddenly. "Well, I have always made it a practice," began Sir Harry. "Have you got any arms?" the Duke cut him short. "No, I haven't," the Duke
Jock's lips curled. "You wouldn't," he said, and Sir Harry very rightly resented all that the words implied. "Have you, Tanner?" the Duke asked. "I've got a revolver," said Hal meekly. "Good. You at least have a glimmering of intelligence. Do you see him, Hank?" The American shook his head. "There's a ridge running parallel with us," he said, pointing away to the left. "I guess they're keeping up level. We'll see him soon." The girl looked at the deserted ridge, and her heart beat faster. The Duke turned in his saddle and beckoned the guide. "Did you know where you were taking these people?" he asked. "By God and the Prophet," the man protested, "you didn't know Valentini was holding these hills, huh?" The Duke's eyes glittered. "Keep close to us," he ordered. "If you try to bolt when the shooting starts, you're a dead man, sabe?" "Si, senor," stammered the guide. "Shooting? Shooting?" sputtered Sir Harry. "Is there any danger?" "Yes." "Danger to us?" He received no answer. For the next 10 minutes, they rode without speaking a word. Sir Harry thought a great deal. "As you have taken so much trouble," he said at last, "I feel it is only my duty as a Christian and a gentleman to tell you that I have every reason to believe that an enemy of yours—" "Bill Sluer," interrupted the Duke brusquely. "Yes, I know all about him. In fact, I happen to know that he's prepared a little ambuscade for my especial benefit. He is waiting for my return tonight." He said this in a matter-of-fact tone, as though referring to a dinner engagement. Alicia looked at him in some concern, and he smiled. "I'm not worrying about Bill," he said. And he pointed to the ridge. End of section 39. Section 40 of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace. This is a LibriVox recording and is in the public domain. The Duke Adventures, Part 6. Crack! The Duke's horse reared, but he pulled it down. "Half right! Gallop!" He caught the bridle of the girl's horse and cantered to where a little hillock afforded a rough entrenchment. "Don't dismount. The hill covers you," he said, and plucked a carbine from his saddle bucket. He handed the reins of his horse to Sir Harry and swung to the ground. Hank followed him up the little hill, and Alicia heard them talking. 400? Said Hank. "A little further, I should say," said the Duke. "This air is wonderfully clear and deceptive." "We'll give 'em 500, concluded Hank. "That will be nearer the mark," agreed the Duke. Very deliberately, they adjusted the sights of their carbines. "I think," she heard the Duke say, "that the gentleman in the white nightshirt is some sort of a leader." Hank raised his weapon. For a moment, his cheek cuddled the stock, and the slim barrel pointed at the invisible enemy. Bang! Her horse moved restlessly, and Sir Harry was all but unseated. Bang! The Duke fired. "Got him," said Hank, and waited. In a minute, the two came running to their horses. "Gone to ground," said the Duke briefly, and sprang into the saddle. There was no sign of the brigands' forces as they emerged from the sheltering hill. On the sandy slope of the ridge, there was a little patch of white lying very still. The girl averted her eyes. The party now struck off to the right. "I had hoped," said the Duke, "to have entered Tangier by some other route than that." He pointed ahead to where a little clump of trees suggested a human habitation. "But isn't this the nearest way?" asked Alicia wonderingly. They could see the stretch of the Fez Road as it dipped and wound across the plain. "It is," said the Duke grimly. He did not tell her all. It seemed unnecessary. He had learnt something of Mr. Sluer's movements, and Bill had discovered something of his. For example, Bill learnt of the Duke's pig-sticking expedition and had carefully gone over the route the Duke would take. Neither the Duke nor Hank had made any secret of their intention, and it was a simple matter to convey their plans to Bill. "We might as well get it over," said the Duke. "Let Bill know we're going out and see what he does." What Bill did was to ride out of Tangier and select a likely spot for a meeting. In an excess of diffidence, he chose a place where he could see without himself being seen, where he might shoot without running the risk of being shot, and not unnatural selection. Unfortunately for Bill, there was a rabbit-faced gamin mounted on a sorry donkey who ambled in his rear. When the man from Texas halted at the little wood 3 miles outside the town and made a careful reconnaissance, the rabbit-faced young man was an interested observer. He duly reported to the Duke. Now, as the fugitives moved toward the Fez Road, the Duke felt that he was between the devil and the deep sea.
Had he and Hank been alone, there would have been little or no cause for anxiety. Indeed, the adventure was one of his own seeking and had been anticipated with some satisfaction. He remembered this and reproached himself. Without Alicia, there would be no cause for anxiety. It would have been amusing to have seen Sir Harry under fire, particularly Bill's fire. "Look out," said Hank. They were nearing the wood. But that was not the cause of Hank's warning. Their pursuers had thrown off all pretense of concealment and had come into the open. The Duke calculated that they numbered 30 in all. There were 3 men on their right flank and 4 on their left, and the remainder galloped behind. "They're trying to head us off," said Hank. "Crack, crack," firing from their horses. "That won't do much harm." Sir Harry ducked violently as the bullets began to whine overhead, and Hal fingered his revolver irresolutely. The party on the right was now reinforced and were gaining ground. They swerved still further away from the little party. What's the idea? This new maneuver was disconcerting. "Making for the wood," said Hank calmly. "It's a hold-up, sure." This evidently was the plan, for as the fugitives struck the uneven surface of the Fez Road, the right and the left horns of the pursuing crescent converged, as by signal, upon the wood ahead. He unslung his Winchester. "There'll be something doing," he said with conviction. His prophecy was fulfilled, for scarcely had the last fluttering white jalab disappeared into the plantation than there came a perfect fusillade of firing. The Duke looked back. The moors in the rear numbered a dozen. He chose his ground. There was a dry watercourse to the right of the road, and into this he led his party. "Dismount!" They were off their horses in a trice. He found shelter for Alicia. "Stay there, and don't move," he ordered peremptorily. The moors were galloping in a circle about the little position. Firing was going on all sides, but it was in the wood that it was heaviest. Flat on the ground lay Sir Harry Tanner, dazed, bewildered, horribly afraid. And after a while, "No bullet seemed to be coming from the wood," he ventured. The Duke smiled. "The gentlemen in the wood have, I should imagine, sufficient to keep them engaged. Bill Slewer is a mighty handy man with a revolver." "Good Lord," said Sir Harry, and the situation began to dawn on him. "If we can keep our gyrating friends at a distance," the Duke continued. "Dookie," it was Hank's urgent summons that sent him to the American side. "What are these?" Hank pointed to the road beyond the copse. A disordered mob of galloping men were coming toward them. The Duke looked long and carefully. "That or those," he said with a sigh, "is the army of His Sheriffian Majesty the Sultan of Morocco." He looked down into the white face of the girl. "In the words of the Transpontine heroine," he said flippantly, "we are saved." End of section
40.
Section
41
of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace. This is a LibriVox recording and is in the public domain. The Duke Adventures, Parts 7 and 8. Part 7. Somewhere in New York, in the Cherry Hill district, lives a lady who at some remote period embarked upon a matrimonial undertaking and became officially and legally Mrs. Bill Slewer. Happily for her, a paternal government deprived her, as stated intervals, of communion with her lord. Bill in Sing Sing was an infinitely better husband than Bill at home. When Mr. Slewer finally disappeared, this poor woman hoped most sincerely that she had heard the last of him. But this was not to be, for that same paternal government of the United States of America sought her out. "Dear Madam," ran the letter, "I regret to inform you that your husband, William Slewer, was killed by the Moorish brigands in the vicinity of Tangier on December 24th last. It would appear that the Moors came upon him unexpectedly whilst he was awaiting the return of a friend in a little wood near the city, and in spite of a most desperate resistance in which 6 of the brigands lost their lives, he was shot down. As a result of the representations of this department and on the evidence of the Duc de Montbéliard, the Moorish government has offered compensation which, although inadequate in view of your terrible loss, may replace the means of sustenance of which you have been deprived. I enclose a draft from the First National Bank,
for $20,000. Yours faithfully.
Part 8. From the Lewisham and Broccoli Directory. Kaimat Crescent. Number 62. The Lord and Lady Tupping. Number 64. The Duke and Duchess de Montbillet. Number 66. Mr. S. Hankey. End of The Duke in the Suburbs by Edgar Wallace.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.